From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young with Tanya Mosley. And on this inauguration day, it is here and now. Joe Biden has taken the oath of office, become the 46th president of the United States. Kamala Harris is now the vice president, the first woman and first person of black or Asian descent to hold that office. And 22-year-old poet Amanda Gorman almost stole the show from both. But speaking on the steps of the Capitol that had been the scene of an insurrection, Biden told a country stunned by that and a pandemic that democracy has prevailed.
So now, on this hallowed ground where just a few days ago, violence sought to shake the Capitol's very foundation, we come together as one nation, under God, indivisible, to carry out the peaceful transfer of power as we have for more than two centuries. As we look ahead in our uniquely American way, restless, bold, optimistic, and set our sights on the nation we know we can be and we must be.
Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe. And Aisha, just first, thoughts about Biden's address?
Well, it was standing on its own, it was very authentic to Joe Biden and to the message that he has been trying to bring from the start of his campaign, this idea that unity, he acknowledged that some people look at it as a kind of a fairy tale, a fantasy. But he is saying that he feels deep in his bones that this is what this country needs. And this idea of that he would always be honest, that he would level with the American people, and repeated appeals to the people that did not vote for him, repeated appeals to those people who are skeptical of him. It was in many ways, of course, the opposite of the speech that now former president.
Oh boy, we're having some gremlins. Here you go, Aisha. I'm sorry. You said former president. Go ahead. Yep.
Where former president Donald Trump, where he talked about American carnage and really gave an indictment of Washington and elites. This was not an indictment of America. It was an appeal to America's better angels.
Yeah. He said our history has been a struggle between the ideal that we all are created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have torn us apart. But, you know, Donald Trump, the now former president, was not there. The Bidens, the Obamas, Clintons and Bushes, four presidential families, the Carters couldn't travel. But so talk about the significance of this moment, given that, you know, Vice President Mike Pence was there.
Mike Pence, interestingly enough, and really he's been doing this in some ways throughout the presidency, but definitely throughout these last few weeks, he played the role that would traditionally be played by the president. He even was on the East Stairs and after the swearing in ceremony was over, you know, talking with Vice President Harris and the second gentleman, talking to them, you know, and then, you know, heading off in his car. Usually that is what a president would be doing. They would be talking to, you know, the former president would be doing, talking to his successor, wishing him well. President Trump did not do that. So, but you had Pence there, you had Republican leaders there, you know, and even after the speech, you know, in the Capitol, you know, giving remarks, giving, you know, the tradition.
Oh, they were giving gifts to each other, I think Aisha was about to say.
They were giving gifts to each other. Mm-hmm. Yes, and a much different tone than what we heard throughout Washington, you know, directly after the election, and certainly from former President Trump.
Right. There were, you know, obviously it was such a different inauguration. Pandemic, of course, was a consideration. Security measures that were put in place after the insurrection just a couple of weeks ago. But there were such moments of beauty, Aisha. I want to listen to just some of the words of the 22-year-old poet Amanda Gorman. Let's listen.
Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one.
I usually just want to take a minute here and reflect on what we saw and heard today. People take my word for it. The words of Amanda Gorman were just stunning, this youngest poet ever to speak at an inaugural. We'll hear more of her for the program, throughout the program, and more from Aisha Roscoe as we fix these gremlins that we have. But let's go to our next guest now, someone who's also going to be weighing in. As Senator Amy Klobuchar said today, it was a day of firsts. The first vice president of color, Kamala Harris, sworn in by the first Latino on the Supreme Court, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. The backdrop of this progress, as we know, has been overshadowed in many ways by the specter of extreme violence, tens of thousands of National Guard troops patrolling Washington, D.C. to make certain this day goes off smoothly.
Robin, let's bring in Eddie Glaude, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and MSNBC contributor, to talk more about this. Welcome back.
It's my pleasure.
Yes. Eddie, do you see a through line between the two things that really have defined this day, the threat of violence and also the joy many are feeling at having a more diverse and representative government?
You know, in some ways, what we're witnessing is this kind of stark contrast between a dying world that's clinging to life and a world that's desperately trying to be born. Or one might describe it as an America that's trying to be born. And so what we see are these elements of, you know, the ongoing contradictions that have defined American life since our founding. And you see those elements that, you know, in some ways suggest a different way of being together, you know, that these demographic shifts that have so unsettled so many people in the country are finally beginning to make themselves known in very clear and complex ways. So it's the juxtaposition of two Americas in some ways.
Those contradictions that you talk about, we see them In our talks with everyday Americans. The most recent NPR poll shows that 65% of the country believes Biden legitimately won. 70% of Republicans still believe Trump's false claims that the election was fraudulent. I mean, this country is fractured. This is actually a sad day for a significant population of this country. What do you think is necessary for the Biden administration to rule effectively? What can history tell us about this?
Well, I think it's important for the Biden administration to respond to the scale of the problems we face. I don't think they need to be invested in the political possibility or of a second term or what are the political stakes of this choice as opposed to that choice. America stands on a knife's edge, and Americans are grappling with unemployment, housing insecurity, food insecurity. And I think part of what the best approach is just simply to respond at scale to the depth of the crisis. And that will impact the everyday lives of Americans, no matter their ideological position. And I think that's the best way to do it.
And when you say respond, you mean respond in ways that actually help Americans and the most immediate crisis, meaning the pandemic, but then this longer crisis that President Biden actually alluded to during his inauguration speech. I mean, he said that justice will be denied no longer. He was talking about systemic racism and those types of things. This message of unity, do you really think that's possible right now? And what does unity actually mean right now?
You know, that's the question we have to ask ourselves, right? So if you just invoke unity as a kind of trope, it without any substance, it's kind of meaningless, right? But what unity actually, what will it actually mean? Does it suggest a kind of new moral and social contract between us, where we give voice to our obligations to each other, where we where we leave behind the kind of selfishness that has defined our way of life over the last 40 plus years and has eviscerated any notion of the public good, that has justified the shattering of a social safety net? And so unity requires, I think, much more substance than just its announcement. It's going to require, and here's the more difficult thing, I think, Tonya, it's going to require us finally leaving behind this idea that some Americans ought to be valued more than others because of the color of their skin. Because the folks who attack the Capitol, who sack the Capitol, actually believe that white voters matter more than others. We have to uproot that if we're going to move forward.
That's Eddie Glaude, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and MSNBC contributor. As always, thank you so much, Eddie.
It's a pleasure. Take care and stay safe.
You too.
On the same steps of the Capitol, where rioters sought to overturn the election 2 weeks ago, President Biden took the oath of office today, pledging unity.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
And to talk about this and the significance of this through an historical lens, let's bring in Peniel Joseph. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Peniel, a lot of people are comparing the feelings of this moment to the late 1800s with the Reconstruction and the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, these moments of great change in our country. What moments in our history does today bring to mind for you?
Well, I think we're really actually living through America's third Reconstruction. And in a way, that Reconstruction period started with the election of President Obama and the belief that Obama's election could transform American democracy from the inside out, finally having this first black president. That turned out to be erroneous, and the visions of post-racialism faded with the birther movement, the Tea Party, the rise of Donald Trump. But at the same time, you also had the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and sort of this new movement really led by black women, by black queer radical feminists that really tapped into a tradition that does go back to the first Reconstruction. And when we think about that first Reconstruction, President Biden mentioned Abraham Lincoln in 1863 and saying his whole soul is in it. And he mentioned Lincoln again when he talked about the better angels of our nature. And that first Reconstruction period is really from 1865 all the way to 1896. Sometimes people end it in 1877, but it's a 31-year experiment in American democracy where you have these striking juxtapositions, just like we have today. You've got President Obama and you've got Vice President Kamala Harris. You've got Stacey Abrams, you've got Senator Raphael Warnock, but you've got Proud Boys and you've got a riot and an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. During Reconstruction, we saw the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which provided voting rights for black men, birthright citizenship, and ended racial slavery except in cases of punishment. All those things were striking juxtapositions because you're going to see during Reconstruction both the rise of a new black political and social and cultural class, but also you're going to see the rise of convict leasing, sharecropping, peonage, black codes, voter suppression, all of which is organized by white violence against black communities throughout the United States. And you see this during the second Reconstruction, too. We usually think about the Civil Rights Movement as a period between the Brown desegregation decision on May 17th, 1954, that ends public school segregation, at least legally, all the way up until Dr. King's assassination on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. But really that second Reconstruction begins in earnest in the 1930s and the 1940s in the wake of the Great Depression, where you see these black women and men who are everything from liberals and Democrats and Republicans to feminists and socialists and trade unionists who are talking about racial justice, a double V campaign, victory over fascism abroad and over racism at home. And the people like Ella Baker and Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson and Mary McLeod Bethune. So when we think about this notion of today, we're really living in the shadow of those first and second Reconstructions that had successes, but did not bring about black dignity and citizenship the way they should have.
I want to bring in Jill Lepore. She's a professor of American history at Harvard and also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Jill, you're listening to what Peniel is talking about, saying that this is essentially like the third Reconstruction. In the context of all of this, what does unity mean? You know, Biden said that unity was his top priority. What does that look like in the context of what we're talking about?
Oh, I think it's very much something that we will need to invent, that Biden can take some leadership on, but unity is not something that one person can present to a community. I think that the process of reinventing the sort of social contract is what lies ahead of all Americans in the years to come.
Oh, Jill, I wonder if you could talk a little more about that, Robin here, and what you might think of the call from some historians who, you know, when Peniel's been mentioning the Reconstruction, they think we are still in it because it followed, of course, the Civil War and claimed unity, but papered over so many injustices towards blacks for over 100 years. Here's David Blight from Yale. Healing and unity came without justice after the Civil War. That's what's at stake now. There needs to be institutional confrontation. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think, you know, David is the author of an essential work on race and reunion after the Civil War, in which he essentially argued, and I think was entirely right about this, that whites in the North and the South sort of had a kind of tacit and in some ways quite explicit agreement after Reconstruction to reunify the country by kind of agreeing about white supremacy and agreeing to forget what the Civil War was about, agreeing to forget the cause of emancipation and the cause of racial equality and racial justice, deciding to, the North, whites in the North deciding to agree with Southerners who espoused the theory of the lost cause that the war was really fought over states' rights. And so there's this profound and deep erasure, both at the level of popular culture and public imaginings and at the level of scholarship itself, you know, with the incredibly important exception of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was swimming upstream of this, of course, so powerfully. American historians participated in that agreement and in that erasure. And I think, you know, David Blight is among those who are calling for a new assessment in this moment that builds on all the scholarship that has been done and the museum work and the school teaching, you know, centuries of work that has tried to bring out the past that has been so whitewashed.
Right. Literally. I mean, an idea of unity, but it has to come with justice at this point when we saw, you know, white supremacists and neo-Nazis storm the Capitol. But Jill, I want to ask you, and Peniel probably wants to weigh in too, but your thoughts about Kamala Harris, you know, first woman of color, first South Asian to be vice president. She wore purple, we're told, in honor of Shirley Chisholm, who ran for president in 1972. Your thoughts?
You know, I got to say, I mean, I'm very curious to hear what Peniel say about this as well, but watching this afternoon, I watched mostly as a citizen, and I was really just moved by the whole, the majesty of the moment and the symbolism, which I found to be quite powerful. It takes a while for me, I have to say, to pull back from the sense of awe and wonder at this moment, the same sense that I had, certainly, in January of 2009, watching Barack Obama's inauguration, and especially on that day, watching the enthusiasm and excitement of, you know, just the incredible emotion of people who were there that day, who had traveled all night long to watch Obama's inauguration. We didn't have that sense of the audience of people there who had made that pilgrimage to be part of that event. We all, I think, you know, watched remotely on our screens. But I still think felt, you know, very much swept away by that sense of occasion and also a great sense of the gravity of what lies ahead, in the sense that, you know, for all the promise of Obama's election and inauguration, that didn't mark the end of one set of struggles that we continue to face.
Peniel, I want to shift the topic just a little bit in the few minutes that we have. you know, all of this in the backdrop of the pandemic, which has killed more than 400,000 Americans. I mean, Biden has basically said this is a top priority. When we talk about unity, we're also talking about solving this crisis of people dying and stopping this virus from overtaking all of us. Do you think that Biden can rise to the occasion at this point where we've gone through a year where we've kind of really bruised and battered?
Well, absolutely. But I think he's got to amplify the words that he used today at the inauguration. He talked about white supremacy. He's talked about systemic racism. He talked about the violence of anti-blackness in this country. And the COVID-19 pandemic is completely connected to that. Racial justice should be centered when we think about our public policy for health, for education, for criminal justice, but certainly eradicating the pandemic. Already, Black people disproportionately are not receiving the vaccine. And that's not just because of the racist history and legacy and skepticism because of Tuskegee. That's because of structural racism and violence that prevents Black people from having health care and getting health care access. So we can do it. And really, this dovetails into, I was very moved by Kamala Harris, too. But we have to remember, Kamala Harris, she's standing on the shoulders of all these Black feminists and organizers that go back to the 19th century who spoke truth to power. So she's standing on the shoulders of the Fannie Lou Hamers and the Ella Bakers, right? And the Rosa Parks. So we can't just be...
We're going to leave it at that. We thank you so much. Angela Lepore, thank you both so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
President Biden campaigned on uniting the country. He now takes office just weeks after a pro-Trump insurrection. The NPR Politics podcast is there every day to break down the transition of power as Biden takes the reins in Washington.
On the campaign trail, President Biden called Russia the biggest threat to U.S. security because of Russian interference with the 2020 election, promising that Putin will, quote, pay a price. But now he will soon be unpacking in the White House. So how will the 46th president handle the future of U.S.-Russian relations? Lucian Kim is NPR's Moscow correspondent. Lucian, is Biden's inauguration today and the insurrection 2 weeks ago, are these things being covered in the Russian media?
Oh, absolutely. What's going on in the United States is of great interest to Russians, and I would say especially of great interest to Russian state television, which dominates the airwaves here. Rioters rampaging through the Capitol or a military lockdown in Washington, D.C. Those are really shocking images, not just for Americans. And the message the Kremlin is trying to get across is that U.S. democracy has failed and that America has no right to lecture countries like Russia. On Russian state TV's flagship news magazine Sunday night, the host compared the military presence in the halls of Congress to a banana republic after a revolution. So there's certainly a bias for President Trump.
Right. Well, but they also must have seen that there was a call for President Trump's second impeachment. So how is President Biden perceived among the Russian people if you're telling us they have a bias for Trump?
Well, Biden is interesting because on the one hand, the Kremlin knows him very well from his days as vice president and before that as a senator. Biden made his first trip to Moscow back in 1973 and sat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So given all this experience, there's definitely a thick file on Joe Biden in the Kremlin. On the other hand, he seems to be pretty much unknown in Russia among the Russian people at large. During the height of the election campaign in the United States, I was really surprised to see a poll that showed 55% of respondents were hearing about Joe Biden for the first time, and only 5% had a positive impression of him. Maybe that's because state media have been presenting Biden either as a doddering old man or an agent of the American deep state. You asked also about Trump. What was interesting about that poll is that only 23% of Russians now have a positive view of Donald Trump. And I think the main reason for that is that despite Trump's open admiration for Putin, relations between the two countries are really at rock bottom.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the future and Biden and Putin. And, you know, as you said, they have experience with each other. What about the recent arrest of the prominent Russian dissident Alexei Navalny? You and I spoke about that. This is after he was poisoned by a Russian product. That drew a lot of criticism when he came back to the country, was immediately detained. Kind of a rocky start. What's the sense of how the U.S. maybe responds to that?
Well, as far as the personal relationship between Biden and Putin, we can say it's chilly. Biden, when he was vice president, once met with Putin and later said in an interview that he told Putin he had looked into his eyes and didn't think he had a soul. And Putin, according to Biden, smiled and said, "We understand each other." All the Russian experts I've talked to say Putin is still ready for pragmatic relations with the United States. But you're absolutely right. The case of Alexei Navalny may very quickly overshadow everything else. While Biden was on the campaign trail, he said he'd hold Putin accountable for Navalny's poisoning. And now that Navalny is in a Russian jail, it's likely this could become a major irritant in U.S.-Russian relations.
Well, this is fascinating. Lucian Kim, NPR's correspondent in Moscow, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Joseph R. Biden was sworn in today as the 46th president of the United States, and he's hit the ground running on his presidential agenda with several executive orders that are largely aimed at undoing the actions of Trump. But perhaps beyond what any one president can do or undo, the wounds of the country cut deep. Let's bring in NPR's Ron Elving to reflect on this national moment of inflection. And Ron, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tanya.
Yes, absolutely. Biden's first action, signing executive orders on immigration, environmental justice, and rescinding Trump's Muslim travel ban. That seems like a lot on the first day. What more can we expect?
We can expect more of same. There will be many other executive orders in the first 10 days. We have been told by Ron Klain he will be the first White House chief of staff for Joe Biden. And Ron Klain has said that these first 10 days are going to be days of action. And we're going to see more with respect to climate change. We're going to see more with respect to immigration policy. We already know the president wants to bring out a platform of immigration reform that features a pathway to citizenship for 11 million people currently in the country without proper documents. And that would be an 8-year program to make it clear, if you will, that they don't become citizens for that period of time. And this is not a bid for votes. We're not trying to just overnight make people citizens so they can vote for the man who perhaps set them on that path. It's a long path, and yet it will be resisted, and it will be controversial, and it will be difficult to get it through the Senate.
Yeah, I want to talk with you, Ron, about something else, you know, beyond undoing Trump's actions on policy. Trump has really left his stamp on the office of the president, really changing the very perception of what the Oval Office represents. What do you think has changed in how the role of president is seen in the eyes of Americans?
Trump has been a remarkably present president, largely because of social media, largely because of his extraordinary media mastery in general, which was on display decades ago when he was a businessman and then a figure in the entertainment world. He is a nonpareil, really, at drawing attention to himself, was so long before he was president. And then, of course, when you compound that with the power of the office of the presidency, all you needed was that name. All you needed was those five letters together, and you had attention. You had eyeballs. And that was true throughout the media. Everybody made clickbait out of this man. And so as president, he was able to put his message before more people more often with more impact than any other president we've ever had. I suppose people would make comparisons to Franklin Roosevelt getting on the radio with the fireside chats, and they were highly effective. And they were, in some sense, a model. And Donald Trump just took that into the Twitter age.
Yeah. You're no stranger to these transitions of power. I mean, you know a lot. You have a lot of history, historical knowledge. You came to Washington in 1984. You've watched this country divide and unite over and over. What's the big thing you're reflecting on today?
Perhaps no other president has had this power I was referring to keep the country riveted on himself. No other president has had quite the same success at trying to redefine reality. And you know, it began exactly 4 years ago today. Well, in a sense, it began far before that, but it was really symbolized by that first day, his inauguration day, 4 years ago today, when he proclaimed that the audience for his inauguration had been the largest in history. And despite tons of evidence to the contrary, continued to insist on that, would not brook having anyone report it differently, sent his press secretary out to say that it was true by fiat, and then later having another spokesperson say that if you didn't think those were the facts, these were the alternative facts. Hmm. And we've really been living with that redefinition of reality on a daily basis in this last administration for the last 4 years. Alternative facts on this, on that, on every issue that came down the pike, including many of the things that the exiting president said at Joint Base Andrews this morning before getting on Air Force One. Many of the things that he said in that last speech were just flat out not true. And yet that has been something that has worked for him and perhaps would have gone on working for him into a second term had he not tried to deny the existence or the seriousness of the COVID-19 virus.
Well, now we are entering another chapter in how we're able to bring Americans back together in our sense of what the truth is and having a unified sense of that. That's NPR's Ron Elving. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tonya.
Well, Tonya, right now, President Biden and Vice President Harris are participating in the wreath-laying ceremony at Arlington National Ceremony. This is something that is tradition, but of course, this year it's drenched in first. Vice President Harris, the country's first female, first Black, first Indian American, and first Asian American vice president, the daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants. As Washington Post columnist Robin Givhan says, crashing through so many doors simultaneously that the full symbolism and impact of her ascension must be reckoned with piecemeal. Robin is Washington Post senior critic at large. She writes on politics, race, and the arts, and a Pulitzer Prize winner for her thoughts on just these cultural moments. And Robin, we're thinking, too, that Harris's husband, Doug Emhoff, will be the first second gentleman, the first Jewish person married to either a president or vice president. First Lady Jill Biden, a teacher, will be the first first lady. But, you know, just stay with Kamala Harris for a moment. 2 weeks after an insurrection by mostly white pro-Trump extremists, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that it was incredibly powerful to see her standing there, you know, in the aftermath, so to speak, of that attempted insurrection. And I thought it was also just incredibly telling the way in which she, you know, sort of symbolically decided to bring along so many people with her. You know, the fact that she was standing there wearing, you know, a coat that had been created for her by an African-American designer. It's a small thing, but, you know, coming out of a period in which I think so many Americans felt as if they were being told that they didn't have a claim, a rightful claim on the country, that small gestures like that speak volumes.
Yeah. And you wrote also this week that Jill Biden, the new first lady, who is often overshadowed, is making history of her own.
She really is. She has made the decision that she will continue to teach, which makes her the first lady who will, you know, have a full-time job outside of the White House, a paid job outside of the White House. And, you know, that, I think, in many ways, sort of resonates in a much more intimate way with women because, you know, very few can become vice president or president, but, you know, so many women who are into professional households or into working households sort of grapple with this idea, and there remains, unfortunately, a cultural assumption that when push comes to shove, it's, you know, it's the female half of a partnership that will pull back from a career. And, you know, doing that, I also think reshapes how we think of the role of First Lady, which has always been so murky, and allows the First Lady to not be an appendage to the president, but a woman in full.
Yeah. And just briefly reflect on the first family. We know the such sad history. Biden's first wife and daughter killed in a car crash. Joe and Jill Biden raised Joe's sons, Hunter and Beau. Beau dies of cancer. They also have a daughter together, Ashley, but we know Hunter wrestled with accusations that he was influence peddling. No investigations found that. But just in the few seconds, the family, what as we see a family exit that sold the family name, which was Trump.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that really strikes me is that the sense of empathy that we hear so much about coming from President Biden really is something that runs through the family and really seems to have come from a place of having struggled with hardship, which a lot of Americans can relate to, and come out the other side of it having talked about it and grappled with it and dealt with it, which I think is really what the country's looking for right now.
The Washington Post's Robin Givhan, as we listen to Lady Gaga, who sang today at the inauguration. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Years ago, shortly after Donald Trump was elected, I visited Robert DeLosa's high school class at Lowell High School in Massachusetts. Like millions of other teachers, Mr. DeLosa has spent the last 4 years guiding students through this historic time in our nation's history.
The social studies teachers across the country, we have a huge, huge task before us, and I think we don't say thank you enough.
And he and others continue that work today. Mr. DeLosa, welcome to the show, and it's nice to talk with you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Robert, back in 2016, you let me sit in as your students were leading discussions about the outcome of that election. So much has happened since then, and today is different because your kids are learning remotely, but the task is the same. What are you asking your students to watch for and think about?
So I'm asking them to look at President Biden's inaugural address and to look for the things that he's talking about in terms of his priorities and his programs, and then to listen to each other about what they think, and to listen carefully with empathy and critically so that they are coming to conclusions themselves about what they think they will see from this new administration.
Oh, this is really interesting because you're not just teaching students to listen, you're actually teaching them how to listen. And many of your discussions start with the preamble. You look at the words, we the people, and who we the people refers to. What kinds of answers are students giving you?
The latest set that I've gotten have included answers that have ranged from the people in power. There are students who will say white people. We have students who do see the people as us. So they're really all over the place when you ask them that question.
I was really struck, too, when I visited Lowell, that the political discussions in their homes were varied, too, as we would expect them to be. But back then, there was definitely a clear mix of Trump and Clinton supporters. They talked a lot about the discussions that their families were having at home. How do you manage those differences in the classroom?
So in the U.S. history class that I'm teaching right now, for instance, there is a student whose grandfather is a diehard supporter of former President Trump. And he has come with honest questions. And he needs answers that aren't based in kind of, you know, how can you think that? And it's also good for him and for other students to hear for instance, from our African-American students, their feelings of the racialization of some of these events. And so I think it's good for all of them to be grappling with those sorts of issues in a place where they're in a common endeavor to learn more about their country.
You note that you've been focusing on the history of public education in the U.S. There's this 1776 commission. It's a group formed by the Trump administration to review how U.S. history is taught in schools. They released a report this week that claims Americans are being taught a false narrative about the nation's founding, and that is reckless and attempts to frame American history around the idea that the United States is not an exceptional country, but an evil one. You and I spoke at great lengths 4 years ago about some of the flawed or incomplete narratives that students are taught in schools. How has the discussion of teaching a clearer, more complete picture of history changed for you over these years? And how are you reflecting on this idea in this moment?
So there are the professional organizations that I belong to, for instance, the NCSS and the AHA, the American Historical Association, have come out pretty clearly against the 1776 document. For our students, I think the most important idea is this one in the preamble of we the people. Not everybody agrees with who the people are, and I think that a lot of the strife that we're seeing all around is this clash of ideas about who the people are. And if we teach constitutional rule of law, which I think is a bedrock idea in U.S. history and social studies in general, that we want responsible citizens, then we do have to face those controversies head on. So that's an important point for all of us to realize.
Robert DeLosa is a history teacher and also serves as the Social Studies Department Chair at Lowell High School in Lowell, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for this conversation and the work you're doing with students.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.